our children, people and retirees, and they will not. Our children will go to schools and kindergartens, and theirs will hole up in the basements because they are not able to do a thing. This is exactly how we will win this war.
Six schools were hit only this week. They would like to create a humanitarian crisis here, so as many of us leave as possible. They think that this is their land and the Russian-speaking people are foreigners. They want us to leave to Russia. That's why they shell civilians here every day.
In 2014, School 57 was hit on the exact day the students returned for the school year. 10 people were killed.
Now, for obvious reasons, for the last 8 years, children here in Donetsk have learnt from home. The school around the corner was hit on the 30th of May this year. And on that day, children were expected or scheduled to come back to school for exams, which begs the question, are the Ukrainian army trying to maximise casualties here at these schools?
There are wounded and killed people every day. Children are dying too. My son is 4 years old. He hasn't seen peaceful life yet. He knows what war is, though. And he likes the soldiers who defend us. When my district was on the shelling, we were hiding in the corridor. He was afraid. He took the phone and started shouting into it, "Please, soldiers, come and help us." I think every mom here has got a similar story.
During 8 years of conflict, 117 children have been killed in the DPR. The Ukrainian government claims the city is still part of its country. The inescapable fact is that NATO is arming a government that is using its weapons to blow up, as it claims, its own schools and to target children. Perhaps the most shocking part of this story is that most of the world has turned a blind eye to the mountain of evidence of these crimes for 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Thousands of Iranian Muslims have come together in capital Tehran to celebrate the birth anniversary of Imam Reza, the 8th infallible Shia Imam. People from different walks of life took part in the ceremony to pay respect to the lofty status of Imam Reza, who is considered by Iranians as a symbol of divine love and affection.
I'm here to say that we love Imam Reza from the bottom of our hearts. I have raised my children with a love for Imam Reza. We are ready to die for him, and we will continue his path.
The ceremony comes almost 10 days after France awarded a movie titled Holy Spider during the Cannes Film Festival, which Muslims believed insulted Islamic sanctities.
Iranian officials believe that awarding the movie Holy Spider is insulting and politically motivated and is the product of the confused mind of a Danish-Iranian filmmaker, sponsored and financed by global arrogance.
People strongly condemn the move by France, saying such a sacrilegious act will never be forgotten.
I want to send this message to the enemies that the light of the sun will never fade away. So the name and the path of Imam Reza will remain forever, and the enemy's plots will never bear any results.
I believe that awarding the movie Holy Spider has been totally politically motivated, and it was an open insult to Islamic sanctities. We condemn such a movie, and we condemn such a sacrilegious act against Islam.
The participants believe that the large gathering of Muslim believers has sent this message to the enemies of Islam, that Muslims will never remain silent and indifferent towards any insult against their sanctities, and they are ready to defend their Islamic values and beliefs until the last drop of their blood. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The moment an exhibition turned into a series of violent assaults committed by the MKO, a cult-like organization that has the blood of 17,000 Iranians on its hands. Press TV's camera crew, reporting on an exhibition showcasing MKO bombings and assassinations, was attacked by angry supporters of the group.
Don't touch my camera. Don't touch my camera.
Go deep.
Don't touch my camera.
You go deep.
After being driven out of post-revolution Iran, the MKO based itself in Camp Ashraf in Iraq, where members were forced to pledge allegiance to its leader Massoud Rajavi and demonstrate that allegiance with cult-like behavior. For women, that meant divorcing their husbands and marrying him. Many families spent years on the fringes of the camp begging for their children to be released, but to no avail. The camp was later dismantled in the wake of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Until 2012, the MKO was on the U.S. terrorist list. It was also blacklisted by the EU until 2009. Since being removed, the new leader of the cult, Mariam Rajavi has forged close relationships with Western officials.
What unfolded on the streets of Stockholm today was a shocking reminder that the EU has become a safe haven for the MKO, which attacks journalists like myself with little fear of retribution. The question now is, will there be an investigation? Bianca Rahimi, Stockholm.
We are visiting Afghan food markets, where prices are hiking day by day. Food items are short, and people don't have cash to buy them. Customers here tell us about their struggle to provide food and livelihoods.
If I save the whole salary of my 20 days of work, I will be able to buy a sack of flour, because I hardly can make only a dollar per day. However, most of the days, I'm without the job. In such a situation where prices are also skyrocketing, I can no longer provide livelihoods for my family.
On Wednesday, the UN chief said the impacts of the war in Ukraine have generated food and finance crises globally, with vulnerable ones being hit hard. Afghan experts say Afghanistan is among the countries affected harshly.
Previously, the prices of food items, including that of flour, were lower. Since the beginning of Russia-Ukraine conflict, the prices have started to rise. Then a sack of flour was $17, but now it is nearly $30. Unfortunately, our country is also facing an unprecedented drought that has a significant role in food shortages.
In the meantime, Afghan traders and businessmen also complain about the severe impacts of freezing Afghan assets by the U.S. and global sanctions on the country.
The U.S. seizing of Afghan assets has left a severe effect on our markets and livelihoods. Earlier, a dollar was exchanged with 77 Afghanis, but now, due to U.S. sanctions, a dollar has been raised to 89. We urge the U.S. and the international community to not add to the miseries of Afghan people and free their frozen funds as soon as possible.
Following the Taliban takeover, the U.S. and allies froze some $9 billion in Afghan central bank assets, and major funding to the country was halted.
Sanctions and ripple effects from the war in Ukraine have triggered food crisis in Afghanistan. Most people here say they can afford a single sack of flour, since the prices have more than doubled. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
We're on our way to the front line, outside the key Ukrainian stronghold of Avdiivka. We pull up by the side of the road. It feels like no man's land.
The town is fortified well, but we're working on them, dismantling their dugouts with artillery. We're making passages in their defenses and going deeper. You can hear our volleys now.
Now, it's too dangerous to take the car along this road, as it can be a target for anti-tank missiles fired from the Ukrainians, who are just about a kilometer in that direction, so we're going on foot.
These fighters are from the Donbas, now loyal to Russia. They've been fighting here against Ukrainian nationalists for 8 years. Trench warfare has returned once again to Europe. While some of the world's most advanced weapons are slaughtering dozens of soldiers every day, the best defense remains underground. The living quarters, it's infested with kittens. The soldiers tell me that they have them at every outpost. They bring good luck, they say. More likely, much needed comfort in this brutal war.
Now, Avdiivka is just over in that direction there. It's so well fortified that risking a frontal attack would cost so many lives, or indeed may not even be possible. That's why the Russian army is trying to encircle the Ukrainian army to the north of here. And then, after it does that, if it's able to do that, they plan to come down here and take Avdiivka. Because to take Donbass, the whole of Donbass, it's major fortifications like this, which will have to be taken as well.
The remains of mortar shells. The trenches are doing their job. It's been some time since Russia has released its casualty figures, perhaps because the number might be hard for Russian people to swallow. But it's clear, with overwhelming air and artillery superiority, Russia is winning this war, where the fighting is fiercest. The next outpost, as promised, more kittens. Russian soldiers are being dehumanized by Ukrainian propaganda as monsters and orcs, leading to atrocities committed against Russian POWs. But it's clear these soldiers are very human indeed. Upon hearing I was British, one of the soldiers appealed to me to tell the truth about what was happening here to people back in the UK. I asked him what that truth was.
that there's a genocide of the Russian-speaking population going on here. The Ukrainians have been shelling our people for 8 years. They are trying to extinguish us. Tell them about this at least. At any moment, I can die here, but I am on my land and I will fight for it.
No doubt the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches across the fields will have a very different version of the truth. Compromise is being achieved through war. Appropriately for this European conflict, poppies grow in the trenches. Many years from now, perhaps soldiers from both sides will be able to commemorate their fallen comrades together. But for now, the battle for the Donbass rages on. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
The majority of the EU's 705 legislators do support the 27-nation bloc's handling of the Ukraine conflict, but a growing minority are very unhappy. On the issue of sanctions, the EU has been accused of double standards and hypocrisy.
C'est que quand la Russie attaque...
If Russia attacks Ukraine, there will be sanctions. When the US bombs Iraq, no sanctions. When Saudi Arabia bombs Yemen, no sanctions. When the EU destroys Libya, no sanctions. When Israel colonizes Palestine, no sanctions.
When dissenting voices in the European Parliament highlight Ukraine's history of corruption or the need for greater diplomatic efforts with Russia, they are often shut down.
Please, dear colleagues, try to do preventive diplomacy. As somebody who has gone through
you
the
have
war,
to come to
I know
end.
That war does not resolve anything. Thank you.
Mainly due to the conflict, energy and food prices continue to soar in the EU, placing enormous financial hardship on citizens. Despite this, it seems the focus remains fixed on weapons.
Our unprecedented military support package of 2 billion euros under the European peace facility helps Ukraine defend its population.
Some analysts blame NATO and the EU, directed by the United States, for provoking Russia into military action.
And now, for Ukraine, it's a very bad situation. For Russia also, and for Europe, it's a very bad situation.
Any of the 27 leaders in the EU can veto key policies in the European Council. For example, Hungary has been blocking a total ban on Russian oil imports. Some lawmakers want the veto option to be scrapped.
For 1 month, we put our indecisiveness out on full display. And what was the outcome? The perception that one member state won and the EU as a collective lost.
Other lawmakers disagree. They say it would be yet another example of the EU moving away from being a peace project and towards becoming a federalist superpower to benefit big business, including the arms industry. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
The UK has marked the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. The royal family paraded the capital over the long bank holiday weekend, and Transport for London finally opened the long-awaited Elizabeth line. But strikes put a damper on things, with members of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, desperate for better pay, walked off the job. Rose works for TfL. After a long day on the picket line, she spoke at the People's Assembly. The cost of living crisis has hit hard, but who will bear the brunt?
This is affecting all working people of all different types in all parts of the country. And that means that we do have to come together. We do need to recognise that we are in this fight together.
The government must act. It must act to make sure that children aren't hungry. It must act to make sure that people don't lose their homes. It must act so that people can go on holiday. That's an important thing as well. And we're going to lose all of that across the next few months unless the government changes course.
The speakers insisted the key to success was unity. Massive rallies are being planned and people from a myriad of causes will be attending.
We're in a situation now where in the most serious cost of living crisis, the most serious attack on working people that there's been for generations, our government is considering increasing what is already a massive defence budget, a massive arms spending budget. And that seems to us to be completely absurd and actually disgraceful.
The speakers here today warned that dire poverty is knocking on the doors of millions of people across the UK, and the government has no intention of intervening. Record price hikes have already happened, and more is just around the corner. Food, fuel, energy bills, mortgage premiums, National insurance contributions and tuition fees. You name it, the price has gone up. Politicians are blaming the UK's predicament on external factors.
But Mr. Speaker, the war's most significant impact domestically is on the cost of living. COVID and global factors meant goods and energy prices were already high. Statistics published this morning show that inflation in February was 6.2%.
But during the same period, energy companies have reported record profits. City bonuses have gone up six times wages, and politicians have made it to the UK's rich list. Households have been promised a few hundred pounds in relief, but it won't even scratch the surface, as millions of families wonder where their next meal is coming from. Bianca Rahimi, London.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. The Limelight.
Dumped at sea, lost on land or left to rot in shops and fridges, the global catch of fish is being wasted like never before, hurting not only the oceans but the nutrition of billions of people. But can it be reversed? We present you an article written by Emma Bryce. The piece is titled Millions of Tons of Dead Animals: The Growing Scandal of Fish Waste. In February of 2022, a Dutch-owned fishing trawler released a silvery stream of 100,000 dead fish, which carpeted several thousand square meters of ocean off the coast of France. The vessel's owners blamed the discharge on a faulty net. Environmental groups charged that the fish were intentionally dumped. Whatever the truth, that spectacle of squandered sea life was the tip of the iceberg, Figures from the World Wildlife Fund, the WWF, show that in 2019, at least 230,000 tons of fish were dumped in European Union waters. Most of the waste, or 92% of it, is related to bottom trawling, a fishing method that scrapes the sea floor, indiscriminately scooping up everything in its path. But this figure is a small fraction of an even larger global issue. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, estimates that 35% of all fish, crustaceans and mollusks harvested from oceans, lakes and fish farms are wasted or lost before they ever reach a plate. Fish are highly perishable and fragile, which makes them more vulnerable to waste, a problem that is compounded by hemorrhaging fish at every step of the supply chain. Pete Pearson, Senior Director for Food Waste at the World Wildlife Fund, says, "Fish waste is especially shocking because they are wild animals, so we are harvesting wildlife. Fish populations are already threatened by overfishing, pollution and the climate crisis. With current rates of fish consumption projected to double by 2050, waste is increasingly on the radar of regulators." Omar Pinyaruba, a fishery officer at the Food and Agricultural Organization, says, we have to do something about it. Experts say that begins with understanding exactly what is driving waste between harvest and plate. The task is made difficult by fisheries' notoriously opaque supply chains and incomplete data sets that are also inconsistent, although the evidence is clear that most fish waste starts at the point of extraction. Just under half of all fish consumed by people is wild, caught at sea. Pete Pearson says, there's such an abundance that we've grown to be okay with certain loss rates, although noting that 34% of global marine stocks are now overfished. Bycatch, unintentionally caught unwanted fish, is a growing problem. Roughly 10% of wild caught fish are discarded worldwide each year, representing 8.6 million tons of animals. The main culprits are imprecise fishing gear and policies that allow fishers to discard non-target species. There's an economic driver too. Rashid Sumaila, Professor of Ocean and Fisheries Economics at the University of British Columbia in Canada, says, I think there is a strong connection between subsidies and waste in the water. Although subsidies were historically devised to support small-scale fishers, Professor Sumaila's research shows today 80% of $35.4 billion in annual fishing subsidies goes to a handful of industrial fleets. These include gargantuan bottom trawlers that are uniquely equipped to travel out to the high seas and overfish, leading to discards on an industrial scale. Professor Sumaila says the impact of illegal and unreported fishing is also important, as it is likely contributing tons more bycatch to global fish waste. Fish waste is about more than just the physical loss of fish. For the 3 billion people whose diets depend on fish, it is a lost nutritional opportunity. Shakuntala Tilstead, global lead for nutrition and public health at World Fish and winner of the 2021 World Food Prize, says, the narrative is that we have to produce more to feed the growing masses, but the greatest pathway to increasing supply is reducing loss and waste. Many sea-controlled aquaculture systems or fish farms which generate more than half of our fish supply, as a solution to the waste of wild fishing. But Dave Love, senior scientist at the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, says that various factors such as disease are driving considerable losses on fish farms too. Dave Love says mortality in fish ponds is actually a significant source of lost potential food. Fish waste continues after harvest, though how it unfolds differs depending on location. Omar Pinarubia says the Food and Agricultural Organization estimates that 27% of all fish globally is lost or wasted after landing. But in low-income countries, the fish is more likely to be unintentionally lost than wasted. One study showed that in Ghana, in Burkina Faso and Togo, 65% of lost fish on land was attributable to poor handling, lack of storage facilities and cooling facilities on fishing vessels, and along the lengthy supply chain. Fish disappear after distribution too, but here the culprits are retailers and consumers, almost exclusively in middle and high-income countries. In North America, Oceania and Europe, fish waste at consumption far outstrips that of any other region in the world. Pete Pearson thinks retailers in the United States partly contribute to the problem by prioritizing large fresh fish to sell at a premium, which quickly spoil. He says, "This is the real tragedy because it's moved all the way through the supply chain, and then we're comfortable with a 10% to 30% loss rate in the grocery store." Dave Love published a research showing that retailers were responsible for about 16% of wasted seafood in the United States, while up to 63% comes down to consumers putting uneaten fish in the bin. He says when retailers prioritize fresh fish, the ripple effect is that consumers are more likely to waste that in their homes. Solutions do exist to reduce fish spoilage along the supply chain. Increasing access to cold chain technologies in low-income countries, along with methods such as solar-powered drying tents, could extend the shelf life of fish. Omar Pinarubia says fishers and processors also need training on better fish handling and storage to limit loss. Pete Pearson and Dave Love argue that at the consumer end, we should encourage more people to opt for frozen fish, which could reduce demand for fresh fish in grocery stores and limit the amount that is lost in retail and people's homes. Tilstead suggests diversifying our appetites beyond the ubiquitous fish fillet to smaller fish and bivalves, which can be consumed whole to reduce waste. She says, if our notion of fish is a fillet on a pan, then we are already far down the path of loss and waste because we have reduced the edible part to such a small portion of the whole. Existing fish byproducts can be captured and turned into new ones. Fish heads, fish fins and bones from the fishing industry are already a source of fertilizer and feed. Now innovators are finding uses for everything from fish skin for burn treatments and crustacean waste to make biodegradable packaging. However, Pete Pearson, who cautions that we shouldn't overstate these solutions, says, the idea of full utilization is something that needs to be pervasive across all food supply chains. Unless fish byproducts replace a share of fish demand, they are simply making use of waste, not reducing it at source. Ultimately, Pete Pearson says, prevention is the best solution, starting at sea, where this problem begins. Fishers need to be equipped with more selective gear for fishing and aided by policies that discourage discards. Professor Semela underscores the need for good subsidies that can be channeled towards fisheries that help replenish wild stocks. He says, we need to spend taxpayer money in ways that reinforce positive feedback from people to nature and from nature to people. Pete Pearson says, for generations we've believed the ocean is huge and we can just take whatever we want from the ocean. Now we're coming to see the limits of that. And when you have limits, it requires you to become more efficient.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. The Venezuelan president has visited the Islamic Republic. In this visit, a strategic 20-year pact was signed which would further enhance these two oil-producing giants. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what strategic significance these two countries have with each other and how they fit in this new world order that is unfolding, especially when it comes to countering the U.S. hegemonic aspirations. Our guests for this edition of The Spotlight include contributor the Troika Collective, Libre Sankara, joins us from Tijuana, Mexico. Also joining us, journalist and author Daniel Lazar, who joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Daniel Lazar, let me first start with you. Looking at this visit by the Venezuelan president to Iran, it's significant in itself, but what do you think it means when you have these two oil-producing giants meet with each other and form what was announced was a 20-year cooperation pact?
Well, it means a lot of things. It means, number one, there's a very important new team of players in the international oil market. I mean, the alliance between Iran and Venezuela, strictly in petroleum terms, is quite formidable, and Iran can certainly help Venezuela to get its oil industry back on its feet. So they'll be able to improve, help bring about improved Venezuelan output. But I think on a more fundamental basis, it goes to show how the Biden administration in Washington is in growing crisis. And that its attempt, that Joe Biden's attempt to get the United States back at the forefront of the Western alliance are really backfiring badly. The war in the Ukraine is not going well from a U.S. perspective. Nationalism is breaking out all over. Turkey is pursuing an increasingly independent and aggressive policy. And now we see that Iran and Venezuela are also teaming up to counter U.S. hegemony. And there's also, by the way, the Inter-Americas Summit which just took place in California, which turned out to be a colossal embarrassment for the United States and Joe Biden. So things are going very bad for the United States, and I think, therefore, countries like Venezuela and Iran know this and are maneuvering to take advantage of the situation, which they have every right to do.
Libor Sankara, so that is what we're looking at, isn't it? Because that seems to be the repeated tone of this important visit between the Venezuelan president and Iran's president, and also the Venezuelan president was received by Iran's leader. But to counter the U.S. hegemonic aspirations, a country that many are saying that the U.S. is now on the wane, that it's not that military nor political power and sway that it had from before. How do you see these two countries in that sphere?
I mean, while we're talking about countries like Venezuela and Iran that have endured sanctions, are currently under sanctions, and yet they are still developing their economies and they're growing, and they're able to build and partner with other countries, well, we see a move towards multipolarity. And so Venezuela's ties with Iran is fundamental to combating U.S. hegemony in all countries. And like the comrade was sharing, I'm in Tijuana, Mexico right now at the Workers' Summit. So we actually created a summit that invited Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua so we can talk about actual change that we need in the Americas in favor of working class people, because the Summit of the Americas, not only was it not attended, and it was a miserable failure, but there are alternatives that are being created. And so we see the U.S. hegemony getting weaker even inside of the United States, where we're starting to see leftists unite and support Venezuela talking with Iran. And we also recently had a brigade of Venezuelan women that came to talk about the sanctions and the new partnership with Iran and how that helps and how that brings hope to the people of Venezuela. But not only that, it offers an alternative to Latin America to understand that they don't have to be in partnership with the U.S. government if they want to develop. In fact, it probably benefits them that Venezuela is building with Iran, and it allows those countries to want to build more with Venezuela, which allows, again, for the creation of a multipolar world that that goes beyond sanctions and also shows the weakness of the U.S. and the strengthening of countries that are maintaining their sovereignty despite the sanctions.
When was the last time you recall, Daniel Ozar, for the U.S. to hold a summit, in this case the Summit of the Americas, in which you had South American countries clamoring up to attend it because they think good things are going to happen? But yet not only have you had the ban by certain countries like Mexico, where then the other countries sent lower-level delegates. And the highlight wasn't even that. The highlight was that the U.S. influence is no longer there, and its power has decreased in that sense.
Yeah. That's absolutely correct. I mean, my sense is that Joe Biden, in an attempting to resurrect or to restore the American hegemony that existed before Trump's isolationist policies, he's pushing too hard. And as a result, American hegemony is falling apart even more rapidly as a consequence of his actions. So U.S. power is fast receding in Latin America. It's fast receding in China. It's fast receding in the Persian Gulf. And the war in the Ukraine is going more and more badly for the U.S. Now, this is not I'm not making a pro-Russian or pro-Venezuelan or even a pro-Iranian statement. But the point is, clearly we're seeing a rapid acceleration in the decline in U.S. power.
Okay. What has led to this rapid acceleration of U.S. power, Libor Sankara, in your view? I mean, we're looking at many countries now opposing the way that the U.S. is aspiring, especially when it comes to how countries that don't follow U.S.'s foreign policy go on, of course, the sanctions list?
Well, I think we have a lot of clear examples of the fact that the U.S. doesn't really have access to a lot of natural resources. In fact, the U.S. economy is pretty contingent upon things being made in other countries and reselling those things, right? And so the economy and the way that the economy functions is not sustainable. And so what we're seeing are mineral-rich countries like Venezuela being able to overcome sanctions and with the help of Iran begin to not have to rely so much on U.S. hegemony. And we also see that countries that are moving towards sovereignty are creating a shift in Latin America and in the Americas in general to show just how weak the U.S. government and influence really is, right? We're in that time period of elections. Honduras just finished their elections with a leftist candidate. Colombia is in the process of possibly electing a leftist candidate that, if Pacto Histórico wins, right, they have on their platform to reopen relations with Venezuela. And what does that do? Well, not only does that strengthen the Colombian economy, but that allows a new market for Venezuela to continue its growth, again, despite the sanctions. And so what we're seeing is a united resistance against the U.S., understanding that the U.S. is trying to bully countries into positions, but we are now in a strategic moment where those countries' best option isn't the U.S., and the U.S. isn't in a position to force those countries into relations with them. And so we're slowly seeing a shift of power and also people questioning, despite sanctions, how are these countries still developing at rates better than that of the U.S.? And why is the U.S. trying to create relations with Venezuela when it doesn't recognize the president, right? It's still trying to argue that Juan Guaido is the president, but he is not an elected official. He's not the official president. And yet the U.S. government is talking with Maduro about possibly bringing oil into the U.S. As the other comment was saying, right, because of the U.S.-Russia relations. And so the U.S. is in a really bad position because, like I said, they're not creating anything. They're simply reselling things. And so what we do know is that the U.S. historically has exploited mineral-rich countries, and now these mineral-rich countries are retaking the resources and looking for partnerships that benefit their country and the individuals that they're in partnership with. So this talks with Iran is very strategic and very important on behalf of the Venezuelan people.
Can you please tell me the train of thought, Daniel Lazar, that the U.S. has when it sends a delegate to Venezuela to talk about getting oil, to have these foreign companies, Western companies, to start operating again when they're in the middle of an oil crisis, they, meaning particularly Europe, and of course the U.S. in some respects, and then they come out and they said, okay, we're not going to give you sanctions relief like you think. We're just going to give you a little bit of a sanctions relief. And by the way, we don't recognize Maduro really as the president of Venezuela. We are still opting for regime change in that country. What type of thinking goes behind that approach?
I can't help you. I have no idea what kind of thinking goes behind that thought process. I mean, all I can say is that U.S. foreign policy is in disarray. It's incoherent. It doesn't make any sense. And these kinds of, you know, back and forth over Venezuela, being nice one moment, mean the next. I mean, it's just incoherent. Biden has little power in Washington. Congress is not behind him. He's just flailing about helplessly. And meanwhile, U.S. power is contracting with really astonishing speed. We're all sitting here rubbing our eyes as this process takes place before us, and it's speeding up. So I think that, I mean, America's, America is entering into a very unstable stage, which essentially could be a very dangerous stage because it makes it more likely to engage in rash military adventures. But the broader picture is that U.S. power is rapidly receding.
And do you agree when it comes to the U.S. dollar, Libra Sankara, that is also something that's in a dangerous territory? And I'd like to put that in the light where when you take a look at the fact that you have Venezuela has the largest reserves of oil, teaming up with Iran, which also has obviously large reserves of oil and gas. Of course, then you have to add Russia to that again, one of the largest producers of oil and gas. And then you have China. And these are all countries that are in one camp, along with the fact that you have Saudi Arabia, who has just transformed some of its dollar reserves into the yuan when it comes to the transaction of oil, which is the petrodollar system there, showing cracks there. And even Israel, which is the staunchest U.S. ally, is saying that the U.S. dollar is risky now. I have to change that to the yuan. Doesn't that point to the dollar's so-called strength decreasing at this point?
Yes, and I think, I think it's rooted in this the Ukraine-Russia situation and the fact that the U.S. sanctioned Russia, but what Russia did was ally with China to back up their monetary, their currency in Russia, which helped actually increase the value of the Russian currency. And so, again, I think we're looking at a moment where alternatives are being created and being acted upon, and the U.S. isn't in a position to really bully people into forcing them to do things, right? China is strategically allying with other countries that are looking to not be bullied by the U.S., but also to develop themselves, right? The Belt and Road Initiative is strategic on behalf of China to help not only develop countries, but also better their economy as they develop as a growing power. And bringing it back to Iran, right? Iran is simply doing what they see other countries doing, which is looking to increase their economies, right? Again, these are economies that are based in countries that have resources. And so they're in a better position, I think, now, learning from history, they're in a better bargaining position to look for partnerships without the U.S. being the first option and the option that they're being forced into, right? The U.S. is not in a position to force individuals. And so we see that being affected through the currency. And also, this is also a direct consequence of the U.S. trying to impose U.S. hegemony on countries like Iran and like Venezuela. Of course, Venezuela is going to work with Iran. Alex Saab was in the process of going to Iran so that they could get resources to send back to Venezuela to help the Venezuelan people that are currently under sanctions. Mm-hmm. Right. And so this allyship between Venezuela and Iran is strategic on many fronts. And I think on the global platform, this is a big slap in the face to the U.S., slap after slap, because they are not in the strength and position to bully people. And they're currently not in an economic position to do a lot other than kind of scrabble. And like my friend was saying before me, right, this is also a dangerous position because this could lead to the U.S. Trying to justify another war to try to increase its economy, because that is one of the things that the U.S. exports best, war and violence. And so we also have to be wary and pay attention to that. But there are also strategic partnerships happening that would help to address that if it does happen. Now, there's also something interesting happening in Latin America in general. The current presidential candidate in Brazil, Lula, has just shared not so long ago that if he becomes president, he's going to create a form of currency that is going to be based on the Brazilian currency, backed by their resources, and that's going to be, I believe it's going to be called the Sur, and it's going to be a Latin American currency that can be used all throughout Latin America, right, so that countries don't have to use the U.S. dollar.
Right. He has announced that, and there has been some public reception on that. So Daniel Lazar, we're quickly coming to a close here. So we have the map of the world here, okay? We have the Americas, or LATAM, Latin America, in which, as our guests are indicated, and headlines are reading, is Latin America shifting to the left when we take a look at successes like in Chile, Honduras, and Peru, and Brazil seems to be projected to go to the direction of Lula da Silva, and as our guests there mentioned about how he wants to shift away from the dollar. You have, obviously, the eastern part of the world where you have China, and then you have the pivot, so to speak, Iran, Russia, at the forefront there. You have trade blocks that exclude the U.S. You have energy, oil-producing powerhouses like Iran and Venezuela teaming up. And then you have Russia and China, as I mentioned before. Is this a tectonic shift that we're watching that is taking away the U.S. power and influence across the world?
Yes, it is a tectonic shift, but it's a little more complex than that. Just give me one second to explain. The issue here is there are a lot of issues here, but the most important issue is inflation. I don't agree that America's problems are due to a shortage of raw materials. I mean, America is now self-sufficient in energy terms, thanks to the fracking revolution. But inflation is shifting the advantage to raw material producers, whether those raw materials are oil or grain or phosphate fertilizers, et cetera. And so that the balance of power is shifting very dramatically, which is why we're seeing Venezuela, Iran acting with new independence, and possibly even why Russia is prevailing on the battlefield as well. So I think what we're really seeing is a U.S. capitalism going into a major crunch, because the Federal Reserve will have no choice but to jack up interest rates very powerfully, and that will throw the U.S. into a major recession. That recession, I personally believe, will be quite punishing and will have powerful effects in terms of U.S. power projection, the international arena, et cetera, et cetera. So I see the major problem as economic.
All right, very well. We're going to end it there. Thank you very much for your contribution there, Daniel Lazar, journalist and author. And Libra Sankara, contributor at the Troika Collective. Thank you, from Tijuana, Mexico. And with that, we come to